KSFR programming and podcasts are made possible by the financial support of our listeners and by the Reva and David Logan Foundation. If this program is important to you, please consider making a contribution by clicking on the red Support the Station button at the top of our homepage at ksfr.org. Welcome to Here and There. We search near and far to bring you accurate, timely information about important news stories here in New Mexico and the American Southwest, and there, everywhere else. I'm Dave Marish. Not too long ago, not too long after the change of the millennia, a very successful young media mogul in New York City asked himself a very hard question, quote, "I made money for myself and for a lot of other people, but ultimately, what have I done for the world? What have I done for other people?" Figuring that the best answers to those questions would not be found at the offices of National Video, Andrew Lustig sold the company and headed west to Santa Fe, New Mexico, and a new job that was all about helping other people in need. Emergency medical technician at Christus St. Vincent Hospital. Not too many years after that, Andrew Lustig, by now also a master of naturopathic medicine, an alternative therapy emphasizing natural remedies and self-healing, found a way to take his helping mission to the world, from Africa to the Amazon, from Haiti to the Philippines. Then he founded Global Outreach Doctors and sent not only himself but whole teams of medical personnel to people dealing with natural disasters like the earthquake last year in Nepal, or distinctly unnatural human disasters caused by the brutal civil war in Syria. It's that most recent mission, completed just a couple of weeks ago, to the huge Za'atari camp for Syrian refugees inside Jordan, that we invited Andrew Lustig to come and talk with us about. Andrew, thanks so much for joining our Here and There conversation.
Thank you for having me, Dave. What an introduction that was.
Well, Guy, you're going to have to live up to it.
I will say that I was not a media mogul. I was just a guy running a communications facility, and anyway, thanks.
Well, National Video was a pretty going concern, let's call it that.
Okay.
So let's first talk about the Za'atari camp. How did you come to target it as your next mission point?
Well, David, Global Outreach Doctors has been focusing recently on refugee support. As you mentioned in the introduction, we have worked in natural disasters, but the refugee crisis is affecting 60 million people worldwide, and it is some of the worst atrocities that have happened during my lifetime. And we had worked in the island called Lesbos off the Turkey coast with a team just a few months ago. And we were serving, providing medical services to Syrians, Afghanis, Iraqis, Pakistan refugees. And we really wanted to extend our support closer to the epicenter of some of the worst human atrocities, which is Syria. And so we were contacted by the president of a large on-the-ground facility there who noticed our work in Lesbos, which is, of course, the island where refugees are crossing the Aegean Sea from Turkey and then further east from Afghanistan and Iraq and Syria. And some are making it and some are not. And so, unfortunately, we do hear about these drownings. However,
let me just butt in to reference three podcasts that people can go to and hear here in their conversations. One was from the island of Lesbos with the award-winning great international photojournalist Paula Bronstein, who was there for weeks as refugees came across the Aegean from Turkey and were received at Lesbos. I would also reference the context here, the 60 million refugees now on Earth, the largest displaced population in human history, which was discussed very well by Demetrios Papadimitriou of the Migration Policy Institute. Then most recently, a talk I had with Shelley Culbertson, the author of The Fires of Spring, an education specialist who had also spent time looking at the somewhat disastrous, and we will be talking about it today, schooling situation in Zaatari. So pardon those interruptions for self-referential love. And now let's get back, Andrew Lustig, to your visit to the Zaatari camp, which is just south of the Syrian frontier inside Jordan. This is a camp that about a year ago, well, maybe a little more than a year ago, had about 130,000 people. This was an untenable number. The most recent count I have seen is about 79,000, but this still makes it one of the largest refugee camps on Earth. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, David, we brought our medical team of about 11 volunteers, including about half medical doctors and the balance acupuncture, trauma acupuncture specialists. We found that doctors of Oriental medicine can treat PTSD and emotional trauma and mental health issues very effectively. And so this is sort of the group that we travel with. Soon after we arrived, however, we added additional medical doctors from the Jordan region and our translators and drivers. So we had about a team of 25. And we worked basically about 5 miles from the Syrian border at different points within Jordan, at different refugee camps. The most well-known, as you mentioned, is the Zaatari camp, about 80,000. Which I'll mention to you is more than 50% children and a fair amount of women, and then the balance men. And when we deployed to a region and were requested to come, which we were, we worked with the United Nations High Commission for Refugees to provide credentials and access, which is a process in itself. The Zaatari camp is, you know, highly guarded. Is surrounded by barbed wire and military tanks, and access in and out is very restricted. When we arrived, it's a bit chaotic no matter how well you plan any deployment, and this is not a natural disaster where the telephones are not working and, you know, so on. But Zaatari is a location that has intermittent electricity, no running water, and, you know, exceptionally crowded, unsanitary conditions. With a population that is primarily stagnant, though there are new refugees arriving all the time. And in fact, there are something like several hundred babies born a month in Zaatari as well.
Now, Frédéric Drogoul, who is a psychiatrist who works for Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, and had spent a lot of time in Jordan and some of it at the Zaatari camp, said that one of the complicating factors of treating the refugees from Syria is that given what they had all fled, the incidence of PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome, PTSS, is you know, very close to 100%. And I am guessing the fact that the Zaatari camp is enclosed in barbed wire and access in and out very strictly limited only adds to that PTSD stress and dislocation. In treating people there, how does that sort of ground rule, that the likelihood is high that everybody you are treating has some form, from mild to extreme, stress disease, change your therapeutic approach?
Well, Global Outreach Doctors sort of approaches treatment from a holistic point of view, though we have Western and Eastern medical practitioners. And so, you know, if somebody's physically injured, and you offer some relief to that, but don't deal with their emotional trauma, you know, you really haven't treated the whole person, and you really won't attain, you know, better results unless you do. That's our theory. And so, you know, your question about the trauma of living in a refugee camp. Look, it's exceptionally crowded there. They're living in tents and shacks. People are resilient to some degree. It doesn't mean that they don't have the emotional issues that they are based on where they have fled from and the atrocities they have seen. And I will tell you that we've heard many, many stories, and every person, because this is primarily a Syrian, almost 100% Syrian population that has fled some of the worst atrocities that I've ever, you know, heard about in my life. They are somewhat adaptable, and so if they were a barber or if they were a baker or a mechanic, they're actually trying to do some of these things in the camp. So, you know, a barber sets up a chair in the street, he starts cutting hair. You know, a baker is making bread. You know, they're making do with, you know, very difficult conditions, none of which compare to where they are fleeing, such as Aleppo and places like that. And I just want to mention that Frontline, this absolutely phenomenal PBS documentary group that's been going on for decades, it's some of the best documentaries I've ever seen, produced a documentary called The Children of Syria. And it is an amazing witnessing of what it's like for children and a family over 3 years to flee Aleppo after having lost their father and make it to the border. And I just want to mention that if anybody watches that, be prepared to be crying. And while working in the border, you know, we occasionally do break down and cry. And a lot of times when we return, you know, it takes about 2 or 3 weeks to get off of the adrenaline. But you sort of realize what you've seen and heard, and just how sad the situation is.
Emotionally and reporting from refugee camps and war zones stresses you in ways that are, I think, similar to trying to give therapeutic treatment to refugees in camps or outside of camps. And, you know, the real difficulty is that you cannot turn off your humanity. You cannot say, thou shalt not cry. But for a variety of reasons, including what you project to the people you are trying to help, you do try and clamp down and be a little less overtly emotional than you feel inside. Have you got a tactic, a mantra, a way to achieve that balance of remaining open to be empathetic, but not to be bowled over by the huge emotional demands of working with a refugee population?
Well, myself and the other doctors and medical providers have all worked in difficult situations over probably the last decade, whether it be in an emergency room. I've worked in emergency situations in Haiti and the Philippines and typhoons and so on. I think that, you know, we just do our job. I don't have a particular technique. You know, we sometimes treat ourselves with our own medicine. You know, myself and the other providers have unfortunately become accustomed to, you know, pretty difficult situations, and we're there to help. And I think we're protective of ourselves, and if something is, you know, really difficult for a provider, you know, we're there to support that provider and also be quite acutely aware if a provider is having, you know, a breakdown or something.
Being part of a team, whether it be a reporting team, in my case with television, you always had at least two, three, or four more people with you. In your case, you have even more medical colleagues. But being part of a team does offer a kind of inherent therapeutic group treatment of one another. Can you describe at all how you eyeball one another in order to identify emotional need among your teammates, and again, how you try and use the resources of being a team to provide the kind of support that can stabilize somebody who is becoming emotionally overwhelmed?
Well, first, let me tell you that I am not a mental health professional. A little bit of baptism by fire, having been around a lot of this, to sort of pick up some skills of those that are professionally trained. We basically refer patients back and forth depending on what the patient needs are. And, you know, after a long 10-hour day, you know, we will gather together for a meal and check in with each other. I can't tell you we have a particular technique or anything like that, but, you know, obviously, you know, we'll be aware of somebody just seeming like this is too much for them. And on occasion, we've had to have a team member not continue. And sometimes we actually discover that after they return and say, you know, this is probably not the right thing for you right now, maybe in the future. But you know, we work as a team, we share patients, we share medicine, we share techniques, and, you know, we have a bonding that happens because we're working in a stressful situation. And I'm sure that is helpful with keeping an eye on each other and sort of supporting each other.
Now, particularly in the wake of natural disasters, the almost universal presumption among refugees is this is temporary. This is just to tide me over until we can start to rebuild with whatever has been left us after the tsunami, after the hurricane, after the earthquake. And this kind of presumption, again, that the refugee status is just a sometime thing, it's going to blow over and we'll be able to go home, is also the first presumption that most refugees from war assume. The war's going to end hopefully sooner than later, and then we can go home. For the Syrian refugees, there seems to be no end in sight to this conflict. There seems to be no real expectation of safe return to Syria next month, next year, or the year after. This quickly becomes definitive in the refugee experience, and certainly at Zaatari has become definitive as this camp has become more and more openly a semi, if not completely permanent, city in Jordan. We'll talk about all of that in a moment, but right now we're going to take a brief pause. This is Here and There. I'm Dave Marish, and our guest is Andrew Lustig of Global Outreach Doctors, recently back from treating refugees from Syria inside Jordan. We'll be back right after these messages. KSFR programming and podcasts are made possible by the financial support of our listeners and by the Reva and David Logan Foundation. If this program is important to you, please consider making a contribution by clicking on the red Support the Station button at the top of our homepage at ksfr.org. Welcome back to Here and There. I'm Dave Marish. Our guest is Andrew Lustig of Global Outreach Doctors. Andrew, I was saying that, you know, most refugees begin with the very optimistic assumption that their refugee status is going to be short-lived. Even those who fled the war in Syria, I'm sure almost all of them originally hoped in a couple of months, maybe a year, it'll be safe to go home. Now, as I say, this looks more and more and more like a war without end. How does that affect people in sort of the broad scale of normal life? And then let's go to see whether in terms of human, mental, and physical health, the stresses start to cause symptoms. But first, just inside the heads of refugees, talk to me a little bit, if you will, about the growing realization this is not going to end soon, this meaning our refugee status.
Well, if you look at the refugee camps around the world, it's pretty typical that they were built for one group of people, one quantity of people, and have quickly outgrown it. You know, the Dadaab refugee camp in Kenya, where a lot of Somali refugees are and others, you know, was built for something like 30,000. I believe that they are in the 500,000 or 600,000. And that's been there for many, many years. The Zaatari refugee camp, as you mentioned, at one point had 120,000. They have 80,000. And, you know, there's something like a few hundred babies born a month there. You know, it's outgrowing the capacity. At the same time, the folks that are there set up a sort of, you know, commerce, and sort of are just living in this tent city and providing services. And I think that, you know, it's just so much better than where they fled from. And actually, they have a fair amount of services, you know, besides Global Outreach Doctors, Doctors Without Borders, the UN, and several, you know, large NGOs, IMC and so on, are providing services. And so there is some level of acceptance. I have no idea what it's like to be a refugee in a barbed wire camp year after year after year. There is some process of some of these refugees getting asylum somewhere else, very slow and very difficult. And some are permitted to leave Zaatari, but their family must remain, and they are tracked, and they have to return. The process is very difficult. And I really can't tell you what's in the mind of a refugee who can't go back to their motherland. You know, we met a boy who, Bashar, his name was, he's 10 years old, and his entire family's in Syria. His father was killed. This poor boy is missing his legs and part of his arm. And, you know, his story was, you know, I was playing in Syria and I bent down to pick up a box and I woke up without my legs in a hospital. I really couldn't tell you what it's like to be, you know, outside of where you know, love and have grown up. They know the atrocities. And gosh, I wouldn't think that anybody in Aleppo right now wants to be in Aleppo.
Let me say that while reporting in Kosovo for Nightline, I met a 13-year-old girl who had had a radically similar experience. She and her family had returned to the farm after the Serb militias retreated from it, but they had left a booby trap behind inside a water bucket. When this girl picked up the bucket, it exploded, and she lost both of her legs at the knee. Fortunately, she kept both arms and hands. Nightline listeners and viewers actually got her to the United States for treatment, she had prostheses made for both her legs in New York, and she is now running a foundation that provides both prostheses for war victims in Kosovo and is training in New York for hospital management. You know, the good angels came and swept her out of the worst of her situation, and if she has made truly remarkable use of the opportunities that were provided for her. For Bashar, is there any deus ex machina? Is there any outside force that might be able to rescue him from what would otherwise be a lifetime of very restricted, very strongly unabled as well as disabled life?
Well, I want to say that Global Outreach Doctors visited several locations, and Bashar was actually recently placed in a rehab facility called Syriot Without Borders, which means women, Syrian women without borders. And it was formed by three brave Syrian women who had escaped Syria and formed essentially a multi-level group home for mostly boys who did not have families, who had lost limbs or other serious injuries, who are receiving physical therapy and some prosthetics. And so in Bashar's case, who I am in touch with, and who, depending on the day of the week that you speak to him, he's a very, very angry boy. His entire family, except for his father who was killed, is stuck in Syria. We were fortunate to be able to speak to him on a good day. And I actually played some games with him after we treated him with trauma acupuncture. For him, he is one of the more fortunate ones because he is in a place, you know, in Jordan that is supporting him. And I will tell you, Jordan is one of the more generous countries, along with Germany, that is taking in refugees to such a large quantity. It is the Jordanian military that is guarding the Zaatari camp. And there is, you know, growing discontent by the populations in these countries that are taking refugees. With the quantity of humans coming into their country. But Bashar is one of the luckier ones, and he actually doesn't want to wear his prosthetics for whatever reason. So he kind of, you know, moves around on his hands and uses his body to get around. And so he's probably one of the more lucky ones.
It is devastating just to consider Bashar's future, and I hope that he reconsiders, because obviously if he can master his prostheses, and that's no easy or painless thing, the range of his opportunities for the future will be much greater. Syria is a very urbanized country. Most of these refugees are people who lived in cities and towns. They are people, particularly the men, who had occupations, is everything from merchants and professionals to service providers, and the level of services range from very highly skilled to much less skilled. Inside the camp of Zaatari, there is a domestic economy. There are about 2,500 shops and stalls in the market area at the center of the camp. This does provide both a kind of stabilizing opportunity and an income earning opportunity for many, but for nowhere near enough. And as a micro economy, the Zaatari camp is a pretty limited place, I would guess.
Yeah, that's really well said. You know, it sort of shows you the resilience of groups of people that are sort of contained in one place and how they make do. And it's interesting to see all of the products that have made it in there. I mean, at this point, there are Jordanians that have realize that they can provide services to 80 or 100,000 people. And so besides the Syrians providing the services, of course, they need some of the raw goods. And so you'll see limited access vehicles coming in and bringing in certain types of goods to be sold within Zaatari that you know, obviously can't produce their own goods. And then obviously services, people that had skills in Syria. And I want to mention that, you know, it doesn't matter how much money you have when you're fleeing Syria. I mean, you may get a faster ride out of Syria, but ultimately, you know, we heard many stories of 100 Syrian refugees piled into a cattle car and driven for hours and hours and hours to the border. But of course, before they got to the border, the Syrian coyote demanded more money. And so, you know, one thing I noticed about the population of people that we were treating is there were everything from lawyers and doctors to, you know, very, very, you know, poor people. And even as professionals, they don't nearly make, you know, what professionals in a developing world would make. Yes, a microeconomy develops, and it is sort of serving the population, but also the Jordanian population is providing services because there's an opportunity there. There are people that get food stamps and can buy food and get other assistance, and so there are Jordanians selling it to them.
Now, according to Jody Redoran, the excellent New York Times correspondent who visited Zaatari at least four different times over a three-year period up until last September, she was told by a lot of the refugees living there that now there's almost no good or service that they could get in their old town or village or city in Syria that they can't get at the Zaatari camp. These 2,500 shops do provide just about everything that you could ask for. But this is a great example of, if you will, collective resilience, as well as the personal resilience of each of the people who have set up these shops and run them. And in a way, the more self-sustaining and the more permanent in infrastructure and attitude a camp like Zaatari becomes, the more livable it becomes, but also the more segregated it becomes. As you say, this is a camp now surrounded by barbed wire and security. Transit in and out is very strictly limited. And so another thing that Rudaran found is that while people were satisfied with the materials of their lives, they said they felt like prisoners. They felt like they were in a prison rather than just a temporary or semi-permanent residential camp. Is that a vibe that you picked up on as well?
Well, We're focusing and talking about Dadri, which as a refugee camp has a lot more services and facilities than the several other camps we worked on in the Syrian border. And so it's a little bit of the haves and have nots with refugees who are in Dadri, which have access to lots of services, although they are, you know, contained. In comparison to some of the smaller other camps along the Syrian border, which don't have nearly the services, facilities, or UN support. So, I can't tell you that any of the refugees sort of talked about Dadri as a prison. They talked about their limited ability to move. That, to be honest with you, a lot of them don't want to go anywhere outside of Dadri unless it's back to Syria. And based on sort of your earlier comments about, you know, leaving their homeland and all that, I think that they still remain hopeful. And, you know, I've heard sort of these comments like the world has forgotten us, you know, and it's sort of this, they just feel that really, really want to be is back in Syria. So, yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the wider context, because the Syrians are actually the second wave of huge numbers of refugees who have entered and are now living inside Jordan. There were literally hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who started fleeing in 2003, and most of them have still, or many of them, have stayed inside Jordan. The count of refugees from Syria is about 750,000 and continuing to grow. This means that together, probably more than somewhere between 20% and 25% of the total population of the country of Jordan are refugees, either from Iraq or Syria. This obviously stresses facilities, stresses budgets, and stresses the consciousness of Jordanians. About half of the Syrian refugees are not in camps. They're simply living in villages and towns and in cities like Amman and trying to get by on their own, even though legally they're not allowed to join the workforce. And so there's a lot of irregular labor, and even worse than that, there's a huge pressure on children to forget about school and go to work, because whatever they can earn, and obviously it's not much, may be essential to the survival of the family.
Right. Well, they can't earn much, you're right, and they are on a welfare-type system from the Jordan government, which does provide them with food stamps and certain services, including a school, several schools within the camp, and even a monthly magazine called The Road. We worked with that magazine called The Road. It's actually a monthly magazine produced by a former CNN journalist who lives in Amman. And its reporters and its photographers are teenagers. Now, they are volunteering to learn a craft, to learn journalism, to learn photography. And we actually brought several professional photographers and videographers, as we do to most crises, because we want to document our work and document what we're seeing and share it when we return. And our photographers actually provided photography lessons and teachings to these teenagers on how to improve their writing ability and how to mostly improve their photography skills. What you're really seeing is individuals that really can't earn much of a living, but are trying to learn some skills so wherever they land eventually in the future, the time in Dadri hasn't been wasted, that they've learned something that will eventually earn them income, or they've continued to practice whatever craft they have before they fled Syria.
The net, though, as measured by recent visits by Shelley Culbertson of the RAND Corporation, are that about half of all of the refugee children in Jordan, Turkey, and Lebanon are not in school and are not developing, in spite of informal education opportunities like this. Most of these children are not learning skills, are not improving their economic future, and frankly, I see them as a potential ticking time bomb because, as you noted in the case of Bashar, many of these children started out for very good reasons as angry young people, and the fact that they're not getting schooling and are falling behind in the skills competition can only make them angrier. We'll talk about this in a moment, but right now we're going to take another brief pause. This is Here and There. I'm Dave Marish, and our guest is Andrew Lustig of Global Outreach Doctors, recently back from treating refugees from Syria inside Jordan. We'll be back right after these messages. KSFR programming and podcasts are made possible by the financial support of our listeners and by the Reva and David Logan Foundation. If this program is important to you, please consider making a contribution by clicking on the red Support the Station button at the top of our homepage at ksfr.org. Welcome back again to Here and There. I'm Dave Marish. Our guest is Andrew Lustig of Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Global Outreach Doctors, recently back from treating Syrian refugees in Jordan. Shelley Culbertson is just one of many people who have said that in many ways the really single biggest breakdown treating and sustaining the Syrian refugee population is in education. As she said, more than half of the children under 17 are not in any kind of school, and the quality of the schools may not be high, and the fact that within the camp, the schools are separated from, are ghettoized, if you will, from the rest of Jordan, imposes still further deficits. Jody Rudoran reported that a recent test of hundreds and hundreds of high school students in the Zaatari camp, I think only three students in the whole camp tested at high school graduate level, according to the Jordanian educational standard. Did you get a sense that there is this young population for whom time is wasting?
Well, I think, you know, David, you made some really good observations. Obviously, education in a refugee camp, generally speaking, is not going to compare to education on an everyday basis in some stable, you know, economy, some stable culture. And in fact, the children do, not all, some do go to school, but it's only a few hours a day, and I don't even believe they don't go to school on Friday because it's a holiday. And I can't attest to the quality of the education they're getting. And of course, you know, living in a tent city and trying to just make do, and I'll tell you, when it rains, it's just muddy and flooded. I mean, some of them won't even be able to get to school and may not have the attention span and may not be offered school. I mean, I don't know the exact numbers, but you've pointed out that, you know, a majority of children are not in school. And, you know, the idea that it's a time bomb is a scary thought, because this is an entire generation, millions and millions. There are 60 million refugees in the world, and if a good proportion of those are children and they're not getting education, you know, how bleak does their future look? It's really sad.
And it's actually, you know, in some ways more frightening than sad, because this is a population that is very susceptible to recruitment to various forms of extremism and terrorism, because, as I say, they start out angry, and then they see themselves as being denied access to an economic future. And of course, at the other end of that pipeline, there's another huge problem, and that is if you graduate from your school in the refugee camp, there are no jobs for you in the outside world of Jordan, and damn few in the outside world beyond Jordan. And although there is a domestic economy within the camp, and in some ways it's remarkable for its own achievements, it is nowhere near a sufficient job creator for the adults who are already there, much less for these generations of children who are being educated and then released, and there's no job for them.
Well, refugees are, by the nature of how they've come to a country, illegally in that country, and they are not afforded, this is true in Jordan and probably everywhere, any of the services once outside the contained refugee area. So no health care, none of the services that a citizen of that country would receive. And so yet another reason why they wouldn't necessarily be seeking to kind of get out of that camp and be, you know, within Jordan. Of course, there are some exceptions, and some refugees are able to get official asylum or potentially, and I don't know how that works exactly, but yeah.
It is a hideous problem, and let's again stipulate that even without any refugees, the Jordanian economy is not robust. It does not create enough jobs to supply their own children and their own adults. The unemployment rate in Jordan is high, and that doesn't even deal with the fact that 20 to 25% of the population of the country are refugees who have both social and cultural and legal limits placed on them as economic actors. We've got about 4 minutes left. Andrew, one of the things that's remarkable about Sadri and about the whole network of camps inside Jordan is how many different organizations, UN and other international organizations, non-government organizations like your own, operate within this universe. Some of them, like yours, short-term projectors, others of them longer-term or semi-permanent service providers in the camp. When you go, how do you work at coordinating and fitting yourself into this already very complex universe of other medical, therapeutic, and other service providers?
Well, it's a good question. And, you know, it's apropos to my conversations and today and yesterday and for the last few weeks about working in northern Iraq, which is our next deployment in the Kurdistan region to help 2 million Kurdish refugees. And in that case, our coordination is with other actors on the ground. So I've been speaking to several NGOs, to Doctors Without Borders, and several others in the Kurdistan region of Iraq, which is the same thing that we did in the Syria border in Jordan, speaking to other NGOs, what services are being provided, what services are not being provided, what population is underserved, what specialties do you need. And we'll get that information not just from the groups that are operating on the ground, but also from the not just the NGOs, but the local government, the UNHCR, and other, you know, governments, because Spain is working in Jordan, and so we basically do a lot of research and we make a lot of phone calls and we get connected, and For instance, our upcoming deployment to Iraq includes finding out which populations, the Arabs or the Kurds, are not receiving certain medical care, because there are Kurds that are not willing to, that are not going to be given treatment by some, and some Arabs, and there's a segregation. And so we want to learn that culturally so that we can provide for all, because we're not interested in providing for some or segregating which get which services.
Complicating that process is that the Christian population, the remnant that remains, as well as some of the smaller, more diverse sects who have fled the sectarian war in Iraq, have found refuge in Iraqi Kurdistan, so that actually there's a fairly diverse religious and cultural population that you'll be addressing.
No, absolutely. And we need to be able to integrate in facilities and with providers that are willing to treat all. And in the future, you know, we're a small, Global Outreach Doctors is a small organization. Our web address is globaloutreachdoctors.org. In the future, we would like to bring our own portable hospital. It comes in about 20 Pelican cases, and it's about $400,000 or $500,000. And we will not be sort of subjected to what a particular facility that we bring our manpower to wants to do. We will be sort of a little bit more independent. But in the meantime, you know, we do share facilities and personnel with other operations, and we really try to make sure those operations are treating all populations fairly.
Well, if you've been listening for the last 50 minutes, you cannot possibly have missed that Global Outreach Doctors and its founder, Andrew Lustig, are doing really remarkable work among populations in very dire need. So keep that in mind, globaloutreachdoctors.org. And I want to thank Andrew Lustig for joining us. That's our time allotment and story for today. Andrew, thanks so much for joining our conversation.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much, David.
I'm Dave Marish. Our associate producer is Michael Warren. Research and production assistance for Here and There by Amy Marish and Mary Lou Cooper. Operational control by Nick Appalucci. Our theme is by Kate Powell. Here and There is a production of KSFR FM in Santa Fe, New Mexico. You can access podcasts of the program at ksfr.org or davemarish.com or on iTunes. Join us again, please, when next we go Here and There in search of news. Here and There is funded in part by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, keeping watch for strategies that help create a more informed and just future for us all. KSFR programming and podcasts are made possible by the financial support of our listeners and by the Reva and David Logan Foundation. If this program is important to you, please consider making a contribution by clicking on the red Support the Station button at the top of our homepage at ksfr.org.